When I was a rabbinical student at JTS, I was in a midrash class with a professor who started off this way, saying, if you want to know how to get dressed, what to wear, what do? And so he said, you look outside, you listen to the weather, you try to figure out what to do. And he said, well, if you were going to be a real rabbi, and by real, he used a quotation mark with his hand, he said, if you were a real rabbi and you wanted to know how to dress for the day, you'd take out a book of Gemara, and you'd figure out what the day was supposed to be like, and that's how you choose what to wear. And in that encounter was a very important paradigm suggested. So the question is, when you want to learn, when we want to learn about the outside world, where do you look? Do you look at the world itself, or do you look inwards? Do you look at a book? Is the book the source of wisdom? Does the outside world have anything to add to what the inside wisdom presents? So for us as a community, it's very important for us to acknowledge that even our architecture resembles a response. So the name of the chapter in the book is The Necessity of Windows. It is very heavily influenced, and I'm very heavily influenced, by our windows. We have a full wall of windows as our bridge to the world. The question is, do we look at them? Do we look through them? So to jump to a little bit of the punchline, text 5 is a wonderful quote by an author, Paulo Coelho, who some of you might be familiar with. He has many, many important books. One of them is The Alchemist. It's a very famous book. This one, The Warrior of Light, is also wonderful. It's a Hasidic story retold. A young man went to a rabbi to consult him about what to do in his life. The latter led him over to the window and asked, what do you see through the glass? Well, I see people coming and going and a blind man begging in the street. Then the rabbi showed him a great mirror and asked again the man, look into this mirror and now tell me what you see. I see myself. And now you no longer see others, said the rabbi. See how the window and the mirror are both made of the same material, glass. But because there's a thin layer of silver on the glass, you see nothing but your own figure. You must compare yourself to these two types of glass. With the window, you saw others and had compassion for them. Covered with a thin layer of silver, all you see is yourself. You shall only be worth something when you have the courage to tear off the silver coating over your eyes so that you can see and love others once again. So that's the begin. Sof ma'aseh b'machshava tchila. Here's the end in the beginning of a presentation. It is ultimately a challenge to us as a community to remember to look out the window when we're trying to figure out what to do inside anywhere. But the real punchline for me, for our community, is that we are very ready to look out the window to determine what wisdom to let in. The real question is, can we affirm who we are internally as we do that? Because it is actually quite common for us to look at the outside world to figure out what is moral, what is right, what is what we should do, and it is less regular for us in our liberal context to affirm a traditional route. Some of you who might have heard my presentations on dynamic Judaism last year have heard me say similar things, but this is a specific type of lens, a window, into that very same question. So here we go. Let's start with Torah. In Parshat Yitro, the Torah portion where revelation happens at least the first time, we have this wonderful story of Yitro, who was Moses' father-in-law and a priest of Midian. So here's the quote from the Torah. Text 1. Moses sat as a judge among the people, while the people stood about Moses from morning until evening. But when Moses' father-in-law saw how much he had to do for the people, he said, what is the thing that you're doing to the people? Why do you act alone, while all the people stand about you from morning until evening? Moses replied to his father-in-law, it is because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes before me, and I decide between one person and another, and I make known the laws and teachings of God. But Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing you are doing is not right. You will surely wear yourself out, and these people as well. For the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Moses heeded his father-in-law and followed his recommendation. So you tell me, what jumps out first about this? Very good. As Yonah is saying, the first remarkable thing is that someone as great as Moshe, lofted already by his contemporary community, he is Moshe, He's listening to his father-in-law. That's pretty remarkable. I think we don't see that very often in our lives either. Sometimes you can't see the forest from the trees, you need someone to show you. Later, when Moses begs Yitro to stick along, to stick around, he says, Yitro, I need you. Be our eyes. And actually, Yitro says no. So that's a very powerful thing, too. But usually, the forest from the trees, you need an outsider's perspective. Yitro's message in saying no to that request is actually really profound, but not the topic for today. Yes, that is remarkable. Moving back.
What this says is to me that while we all recognize the spark of the divine in Moshe, Yitro, and then Moshe, through Yitro's advice, acknowledged the spark of divine and therefore wisdom could reside in others and help.
Good. So not only looking outside, not only looking to your father-in-law, but acknowledging a divine spark in the other. The acknowledging of that allows the wisdom to permeate where you call things sacred. Right? Divine spark in the outside wisdom means that where you consider the divine to be present inside now has a companion, actually. Herb.
The sense that I find most interesting
right. Good. If you didn't hear what Herb said, he finds remarkable, as we all should actually, finds remarkable the notion that Yitro says to his son-in-law, you will wear yourself out and you will wear the people out too doing it this way. Look, by the way, at the very introduction to it. Moses' father-in-law saw how much he had to do for the people, but his question is, what is this thing that you are doing to the people? What are you doing to them? By the way, our community, again, I think is a real model for that, because it is tiring. It is a tircha de tzibura in Aramaic to have one voice be the center of wisdom and this locus of authority. And so our community's notion of participatory, egalitarian Jewish life means that you don't need a rabbi to be a Jew. Right? It's nice to have a teacher. And it's important to have a rabbi in the community, but is that the only notion of authenticity? It's nice to have someone who knows how to daven beautifully. Do you want one person doing that? Or is it better to have multiple voices expressing the authentic tradition, learning the skills, polishing, everyone yearning and growing, but to have multiple voices? So the question is, what does it do to a community to have one locus of religious connection? What Moses was doing until that point. It does something to them. And Yitro might be suggesting, this is going to wear them out. That's not how to maintain Jewish passion or Israelite passion or passion. That's not how a community is going to be alive. It could be what he's saying. It certainly is what I think we believe. But I think it could be what Yitro is suggesting too. Carol. Right. So, by the way, Carol, it's so funny that you say that, because as you're saying that, something's coming up in my head. Right? Carol was just suggesting, if you didn't hear, that maybe Moses started with the best of intentions, but now he thinks it's real. He's got to do it. It's got to be him. Right? How did Moses start? You said he heard the voice of God and wanted to share it. No, he didn't. He heard the voice of God and didn't want to be the mouthpiece. Didn't want to be the prophet. Right? So he didn't want to do it at all. He said, I can't do this well. And then ironically, he ends up by default. He's not saying, only I can do this. He's saying, this is what I do. He fell into the seductive power of being an authority figure and believing that he can do it well, which he can, but he will not continue to do it well if he's the only one doing it, nor will the people benefit from abdicating that ownership, the leadership, to one presence. So again, the question of windows. Moses started by looking out the window. He was looking for anybody else to do it. Turns out to be his brother. Gracious sharing of power most of the time. But he stopped looking out the window because he was so busy looking at what he had to do. That taking a step forest, a step back to see the forest, because I'm looking at the point in pointillism, I'm looking only at that dot of paint instead of trying to see a picture. That's what you do when you're dealing with details. So the question is leadership model, religious authenticity, and what it means to have relationship also within family enough that you can listen. That probably is the hardest part of the whole thing. Right? Terry, and then Tina, and then we move in.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Hi.
It's interesting that you said one needs to inquire of God.
Yeah.
And Moses is really delegating one to keep on the word.
Good.
And God spoke the whole time to the wilderness and everything. It's amazing that you might think about sharing just that thing.
Right.
It's so holy.
So, yes, sharing that thing. People have read and hopefully read and maybe seen Lord of the Rings, right? What that ring of power does, right? So much so that one of the creatures calls it precious, and it's a drug. In the modern retelling of the story in the film, he's designed by CGI graphics to look like a heroin addict. That's what he was intended to look like, Gollum, the character, right? He is impoverished by the power that he owned. So much so that he couldn't even hold on to the power. No one could listen to him. He couldn't utilize it well because that power was about being an absolute, right, owner of the thing. You become owned by the thing. So then the question is the power to speak in God's name similarly debilitating? And if you localize that in one person, what does the one person become? They become not exactly human. Because in the second telling of Revelation, Moses is sent by the people who say, we can't take the intensity. You go. You can take it. Why? Because you're not exactly the same as we are. And when Moses comes down from the mountain, out of his eyes come carne or, rays of light, so much so that he needs a masveh. He needs a veil. Why? Because people are too scared to look at him. He has become connected to the thing so much so that human connection is now even harder. He needs to hide himself. Right? And so sharing it, I mean, what a mid-process to share it. It probably, he needs to be jolted by his father-in-law, not just have some wisdom come in. He needs to be shaken. Right? His father-in-law, I don't know if you know when, his father-in-law is reunited. He also brings along Tzipora and the sons, so Moses' wife and Moses' sons. And it's as if you read the text, Yitro is saying, remember them? You're a human being who has a family. You remember what it is to be a human being who has a family? Right? And there's something really shocking about that. It's important because if you become so seduced by that power that you hold, that we are asked to wield in different realms in our life by our skills, by our role, by our title, whatever it is, it's really seductive to be that thing. It's fun to own that sort of power. But is it healthy to think that you are that power? Is it healthy to see someone else as receiving it from you? So one of the questions that Moses is being asked to ask by his father-in-law is that exact question. Are you the source of all good? And is that good? Can the people sustain it? Can you sustain it? Let's look a little bit further. Because in the notion of a religious community having some sort of center, well, what is one of the things that a religious community does? We pray. We daven. So what are the rules about davening? And again, this is a response to that. Look at where we are. In the Bavli, the Talmud, this is text 2, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, said, and Rabbi Yochanan, by the way, witnesses, at least in his narrative memory, the destruction of the temple. He's in the aftermath, and he is trying to reconstruct this thing called Judaism. A person may only pray in a room which has windows. Since it says, now his windows were open in his upper chamber towards Jerusalem. It's a quote from Daniel. And the notion that you can only pray in a place with windows says something too. If we are trying to connect to the notion of God that we have in a book, you don't have to look up, really. You actually don't even have to look in. You just have to look at and say it. So you can face Jerusalem from anywhere, from a closed room, with closed eyes. Focus your heart, as the Talmud says too. If you don't know which direction you're facing, focus your heart on Jerusalem. You don't have to be anywhere or see anything. So what is this suggesting? It's suggesting that you can't actually have that experience of prayer unless you can see the universe, unless you can see the world. You ever have that experience of being surrounded by fog and suddenly not knowing where you were and going into a panic? And when you actually emerge from it, like on a bridge, let's say, when you emerge from it, there's actually some palpable sense of relief that the world is still there. Right? So what does that mean? Well, I pray when I'm afraid, but I don't know that I'm with anything to do the praying. But when I can sort of see the sky, or I know it's there, or I see the ground, there's something stabilizing, and actually the permeable boundary of the universe and me. I'm not closed off. That permeable boundary is an invitation for me to extend myself and actually to find my voice, because then I know I'm not alone. Speaking into a void is what we read about 2 weeks ago in the Torah. God speaks to the void and it becomes order, and then God is not as alone. So I don't know that God was praying, but certainly seems like God needs something. And I at least know that we do. So let's keep moving. And when I'm done, I'll certainly be glad to do a back and forth, but I want to present as best I can this idea. In an Orthodox context, and this is true today as it was in 94 when Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik wrote a tremendously provocative article called Rupture and Reconstruction, The Transformation of Modern Orthodoxy. He got into major trouble for writing this article, which means I like it. And he wrote it in a journal called Tradition, which is a mainstream Orthodox publication for the Rabbinical Assembly there, the Rabbinical Council of America. And his suggestion, his accusation, actually, against what happens in many Orthodox communities, and I would say, by the way, in ours too, so it's not really about Orthodoxy, is that in the old country, whatever country that was, if you had a question about how to make Shabbos, who did you talk to? Zadie, Bubby, you talked to your family. You wanted to find out what your family traditions were, you went to your family. Well, with the rupture of the Holocaust, with the change of tradition, because it was very hard to figure out what it was when you lost some of your master teachers, including your parents, your grandparents, your whole world. In that rupture, people, especially new students of tradition, looked somewhere else. You couldn't talk to Bubby and Zadie, so who did you talk to? You talked to a book. And to be a rabbi, you learn from the book. And to figure out what to wear, and now I'm exaggerating, but to figure out what to wear, you looked at a book, because where else are you going to turn? Where is the source of wisdom? Where is the locus of authority? Where is God's voice? So this is not my theology, but his accusation of what happens within some Orthodox communities, especially younger generations who are turned on and look for deeper experiences, is they turn to books. That is true in our case as well. When we turn on many, not just younger people, but new learners to a world of Judaism, and we don't as a community sustain an advanced level of learning, we do the same thing. We exhaust the possibilities of learning because all we're prepared to teach is an entry. And it's a very deep challenge because it places a demand on the infrastructure to provide advanced dimensions of learning so that when you get turned on, you still are looking out even when you're in. It's a very deep challenge, actually, to many, especially non-Orthodox communities. But here's what he says happens in the Orthodox community. Text 3. Zealous to continue traditional Judaism unimpaired, religious Jews seek to ground their new emergent spirituality less on a now unattainable intimacy with God, Bubby Zadie, than on an intimacy with God's will, avidly eliciting its intricate demands and saturating their daily lives with its exactions. Having lost the touch of God's presence, they now seek solace in the presence of God's yoke. Right? Now, I know that to be true, not only because I'm a teacher, but because I'm a student. That happens so much. I look somewhere for depth, and when I'm so occupied with what goes on in my normal life, I look to something not human. I look to the solace of a book to find meaning. But when it comes to looking for God's will, now I'm suggesting what I'm suggesting might be what Soloveitchik is saying. It's certainly not necessarily what Yitro is saying, but it's what I feel. It is not as healthy to look away from people to figure out how to live in the world. That's why chavruta learning is the model of learning that traditional communities sustain. Chavruta means I can't just look at a book. I've got to look at you looking at the book while I look at the book looking at you. The book itself is a mirror, but it's actually a window into you. And when we both look at it, we're looking deep into it so we can look through it to something grander. God's presence might actually be locatable, that's heresy, but I'll still say it, when two or more people try to learn something and discover it together. That doesn't have to be a book. But boy, is tradition a good place to look. In our community, one of the times that we faced this type of a question before I got here was when Rabbi Kelman was the rabbi of the shul, and when we engaged in the question of gay and lesbian inclusion. And for him, it was also a personal journey, as it was for me, but I wasn't here, in terms of finding a way to integrate new questions and new responses in the traditional framework. And so we as a community engaged in conversation, because you can't seek God alone. So here's what Rabbi Kelman ended up codifying. I'm sure this was a communal conversation that he was encapsulating and putting down. So text 6. Our conservative movement structure allows for religious and halakhic creativity locally, where the need for it first arises and where its authenticity can best be evaluated. This is a precious resource indeed, the local, authentic community, the testing of a new idea. And it should not be lightly dismissed for the sake of an exclusive uniformity, which will disappoint tomorrow those whom it satisfies today. Meaning, when a question comes to us as a community, the one that we have not seen yet, and we will face questions, because thank God we're alive. So we'll face questions. It is so comforting to say no. Not to the one who's asking, but as the one who is responding, it is a lot easier to say no. Yes, compassion makes saying no very hard, because it's always painful to see someone's face when you say no. That is awful. But it's a lot easier to not change, because even positive change is a loss. So the question that Rabbi Kelman is suggesting is, how do you do that on the local level? How do you test the authenticity? Because you have to. If you don't test a new question, if you don't entertain its possibility, well, you'll be happy today, but what about tomorrow? Not only you, who does you include? There are people who want to be part of the conversation who can't really be part of the conversation because they haven't been invited in. This book, Torah Queries, is actually an example of that, because there are transgender and gay and lesbian rabbis who wrote the commentaries on the Torah. This book is a revolution. I don't really belong in it because I've always been in. I'm the, you know, middle-class, white, straight rabbi. No one told me I could... Man, thank you. No one told me I couldn't be in. So I'm just in the company of people who represent the revolution. Right? That's why we ask questions. Is this a book of Torah? It says so. We think it is. And it's actually more for the next generation than it is for the current that this book is important, because they'll find it on their library and they won't be asking the same questions. Right? I have this ongoing debate with my dad about what tradition means. Because I grew up with a mother wearing a tallis. And he was one of the rabbinical students and new rabbis fighting for women to be able to participate in davening. So he says, no, that's egalitarianism. That's not tradition. And I say, Abba, that's my tradition. I grew up with that. And it's part of my sacred structure. So it makes perfect sense that we have a generational divide because of where we were born into and what we've chosen to do in our lives. But I pray that in another generation, no one will think it's a headline when a gay rabbi gets hired. Why is that a headline? So I know why it's a headline, but why should it be a headline? So what Rabbi Kelman is asking us to do and wrote for us as a community here is that it is possible on the local level to test the authenticity of an idea, because you can't just talk about it in an academy. You need to live it to figure out if it works. Are you still who you say you are when you allow something new in? Now, I think it's been proven to be true for us as a community that gay inclusion did not change us. It changed our conversation, perhaps. But it seems to me that what I know of Nitivot Shalom is that we are Nitivot Shalom today, and we were Nitivot Shalom then, and our willingness to engage in conversation and to do serious study and to experiment with religious form but grounded in a larger idea, that seems to have continued. Well, the challenge of it, the danger of it, and this is what I want to focus on for the end part of my remarks, the danger of that posture is that what questions are not admitted and what are the limits? What are the parameters by which we define ourselves as a community? Because it's really lovely. And I feel great talking about how inclusive we are. But I also acknowledged a second ago that sometimes we say no. What do we say no to? So I want to look down. Because as a counterpoint, and I know that Arnie is a friend of our community, Chancellor Arnie Eisen, who then was a professor at Stanford, has a remarkable book. This is from 1998. Called Rethinking Modern Judaism, where he writes, this is text 7. I put them side by side with Stu because they're good friends. transformation of practice in the name of tradition is now utterly commonplace. That's us. We transform. We know that. Change is okay. We don't like it on the custom level. No one changes where we put the sugar or the coffee. No one changes the tune for Be'an Arachet. No one changes our Yisker booklet. No one changes stuff like that. But when it changes, in theory, we say, oh, it's changed. It's okay. It's familiar enough. It's changed, but we like that. That's all right. I can learn to live with it. And it need not be elaborately explained or justified, because we acknowledge that change is possible. It has become more problematic, however, because the task must be accomplished without what Mordechai Kaplan called. He had a faith in objective science, historical progress, or the authenticity of modernity. He believed in those things. Modern Reconstructionism is not necessarily what Mordechai Kaplan established in his own thought, but it's in dialogue with that. Kaplan was the founder of Reconstructionism, and he had real faith in objective science. We were going to achieve the unity of all people, all humankind, because science will get us there. I don't think so. Nor does modern knowledge associated with science give us all the answers. So the trust he had in those things, we just don't have. I don't have, anyway. And the authenticity of modernity, right? Emmanuel Levinas questioned everything he knew about philosophy when he, as a French soldier, was captured by Germany, and saw the barbarism that happened in the heart of philosophy. How can the heart of academic ethics also breed barbarism, he asked. And so he abandoned everything he thought he knew, and he established a new branch of philosophy. It's not our conversation, but the point is that we don't actually think that things will be okay if we just think harder. So what does Arnie say also? We are also without Kaplan's hope for the sort of all-encompassing community that would have made the argument in favor of tradition, however reconstructed, unnecessary. In English, we don't have a place where Bubby and Zadie are present all the time, and we ourselves might not see ourselves as the Bubbies and Zadies who are tradition in our children's and our friends' and our students' eyes. Right? We might see ourselves as that, but it is not common. It is not pervasive. It is not universal in any faith community, especially a non-Orthodox faith community, to say that we have tradition embodied in every second of our daily lives, not just in our synagogue, but in our kitchens, not just in our kitchens, but in our bedrooms, not just in our bedrooms, but in our cars and the sidewalks and our communities. We do not necessarily have an inescapable horizon, as an educational philosopher named Taylor calls it. We don't have an inescapable horizon that we know we're traditional so we can entertain the new question. We are grasping at tradition while we are grasping these new questions. And so the authenticity that would give us an easier, quote, easier, way into new questions is also not present, necessarily. I'll try that in one other simpler sentence. We aren't traditional enough to entertain new questions yet. I remember presenting a conversation just last year, and someone said, so when are we going to write a new Sidur? Because I was questioning a traditional theology. And I said, when we know this one really well. Because we don't. We struggle with it. And that doesn't mean we don't have the right to reanalyze traditional liturgy. It means we should really be hesitant before we attempt change. We need to engage in deep learning before we can actually claim the authenticity to respond well with integrity to a new question. We have to respond to new questions. Rabbi Kelman is correct about that, obviously. But Chancellor Eisen is also correct. We don't have the solid footing to do that easily. We had better struggle to retain our tradition as we entertain new questions, which is why I think we belong connected to conservative Judaism, because it reminds us that we aren't the only place that's an experiment. Is conservative Judaism the only place to connect? No, but it's where our home has been. So I want to hold on to that for a second and turn over the page and then end as quickly as I can. I'm not going to do all these texts, but they're really nice. Rabbi Elliot Dorf, who's a teacher at the University of Judaism and a really prolific author, has a wonderful book called For Love of God and People, A Philosophy of Jewish Law. He, in these paragraphs, and these are excerpts from his book, critiques Rabbi Joel Roth, who is also an excellent teacher on the East Coast, who I disagree with most of the time, but he is the biggest mensch that I know in the way that he disagrees with people. And so while I disagree with almost everything he says, he, in critiquing me once, made sure to end the conversation by saying, are you okay? And that tells me to remember that people I disagree with are really fountains of wisdom too. So the critique of Roth that Dorf offers here is very important for us to think about, because Roth wrote the tshuva, the legal response, that allowed the ordination of women as rabbis in the conservative movement. But what Dorf points out in this book is when you analyze what Roth taught, Roth never said the reason we're doing this is because of a moral imperative. He doesn't use the phrase. He doesn't talk about morality. Roth's halakha, Roth's approach to Jewish law, is one based on the law itself. It's an internal conversation. In other words, he doesn't utilize a window, or doesn't acknowledge the window at least, when having an internal decision-making process. Precedent. It's called legal positivism. This is what the law says. This is what the law means. That's the only place law can come from. And so Dorf acknowledges Roth's approach, critiques it. I actually agree with Dorf's approach on this, not surprisingly. And the very end, in the second paragraph where you see the square brackets around the continuing interaction between received law with both internal and external factors is the reason that Joel Roth claimed that law must be the dog wagging the tail of theology. Law comes first. Law is the dog. Theology comes last. You figure out what you believe by figuring out what you do. You don't allow what you believe to change what you do. You have to do it so you can then think about what you believe. There's a claim there that's important. It's not necessarily wrong, but the universal reliance that Roth places on halakha, on law, means that what you believe should not change what you do. That's not how it works. Again, I disagree with him, but that's what he's saying. It cannot be right, says Dorf. It is rather that Jewish law, theology, morality, and political, social, technological, scientific, and economic developments in the Jewish community and in the larger communities within which Jews live, and that's a really pregnant phrase, are all intertwined and each affects each other in critical ways on an ongoing basis. We don't live in a vacuum. Halakha never existed in a vacuum. Gordon Tucker takes it a step further. This is a tshuva that he wrote upon the question of the ordination and the inclusion of gays and lesbians in halakhic life, as rabbis, as teachers, as partners with each other. This tshuva was rejected because it was pointing to the larger ideas. It was a political rejection of it because it spoke, I think, the truth very plainly. So his tshuva, it's available on the website of the conservative movement. Halachic and meta-halachic arguments concerning Judaism and homosexuality. I chose a section that doesn't talk about homosexuality so that it doesn't become about homosexuality. But the question of inclusion is not about being gay. The question about inclusion is, what do you believe about your community and yourself and your tradition and your authenticity? So here's what he says. We are all positivists, that Roth approach. We are all positivists in the same way that we all use Euclidean geometry and Newtonian mechanics to solve the broadest range of problems in the configuration of space and in the dynamics of motion. Euclid and Newton are not only perfectly suited to the small scale of the billiards table, their relative simplicity and linear quality serve us well in most of the tasks we face. I don't know what he's talking about, by the way. I just want to tell you that. But I quote him so I sound so intelligent. But I'll tell you this. Tucker knows what he's talking about, which is one of the reasons he's one of my Rebbes. But despite the fact that Euclid and Newton are splendid and irreplaceable tools in most ordinary matters, we need to know that their, quote, local success, and the word local I chose, I made sure to include this because of what Rabbi Kelman says about local. Their local success does not necessarily translate into global success. When Einstein measured during a solar eclipse the light of a distant star that passed very near the large mass of the darkened sun, he demonstrated that we either had to concede that space was not Euclidean or that light did not travel in straight lines near large gravitational fields. We know, in other words, that there are those phenomena that lie outside the domain of normal observation that lay bare to us the need for more sophisticated, less simple tools of analysis than can be extremely disorienting at first. So that is the only way that progress is made. Again, here's what I think he's saying. I think he's saying that just because something might work on the local level at one time does not mean that you can derive from that the process by which every question will be answered. Egalitarianism is not the same as gay inclusion, although they are very similar, and gay inclusion is not the same as whatever question will come next, nor are they the same as Shabbat, nor are they the same as Kashrut, because change is not the response to tradition. Change is what tradition includes as best it can given a case-by-case system. Halakha doesn't exist in a vacuum. Now I'm just on my soapbox. Halakha does not exist in a vacuum. It encounters everything, but it's a system that can't be compromised every time a new question comes up. Because if we do that, we have no authenticity. If we are ready to lay down the barriers and to say yes because it feels right or because I've done it before or for whatever reason, because kashrut is hard, then we're forgetting that kashrut can be a way of connecting to people and to the world, that it is our tradition, that inclusion is a traditional response, not a response at tradition. So I'm going to end with one last quote. It's from a wonderful book by a teacher of mine named Jay Michelson. This just came out last month as well. He'll be speaking in our community in February. My real relationship with him is that he was my frisbee coach at Camp Vermont in the Berkshires. And he is a wonderful author and a journalist. And he is he's a very, very important person for many, many people in the world. And this book is called Everything is God, The Radical Path of Non-Dual Judaism. And I have one quote from him, not only because I really care about him, but because I think he's pointing to something magnificent. And I am disturbed and both affirmed by it at the same time. Hence, non-dual. So, here's his quote from page 4. Non-duality, and I'm not going to try to define that. He's going to spend a whole book, buy the book, it's a good book. He'll sign the book in February when he comes. Non-duality, if true, is necessarily a universal truth, and all schools and teachers are but skillful means of apprehending it. Everything is God. That's what he's saying. I can't say what that means except that I actually agree with him in my soul of souls, and I'm terrified by it at the same time. However, non-duality does not erase the world in a hazy cloud of oneness. The general takes the form of the particular. The one wears the drag of the many. And so, as the world is reborn, our particularities matter anew, and with my background and accidents of birth, the Jewish way continues to resonate in my heart. At times along the non-dual path, I've surrendered all that is particular. Not just all that is Jewish, but also many important particularities of gender, sexuality, class, and ethnicity. Yet when I, quote, return to the marketplace, to paraphrase the Zen ox herding parable, all these forms return. Jewish forms are neither superior nor necessary, but they are superior and necessary for me, because they are the vocabulary of my heart and the technology of my body. So I ask you not necessarily to agree with anything you just heard, except to let it in just for a second and try it on. Judaism is not better, but it's ours. That's a chosenness that I can live with, actually. And that also means the particular path, which sometimes distinguishes me from the universal, is my way into the universal because it's discernible. It makes sense because it's a system that I use. Because when I'm in it, it forces me, it commands me to use windows. I can't pray without them, because where is God then? Song of Songs says God is peering in through the latticework. I better be looking out the latticework. So I'll end with one last quote. Alfred Lord Tennyson was a tremendous, tremendous poet, and if we're letting outside voices in, why only quote Jewish sources? In his poem called The Lady of Shalott, he points a tremendously tragic portrayal of an artist. She sits by a loom, and she sits high in a tower, and the tower has a room that she's in, and the room has a window, but she's forbidden from ever looking out the window. What she's allowed to do to encounter the world is to look through a suspended mirror. Because what will happen if she looks out the window, the poem says, a curse will fall upon her and she will lose her ability to make art. She will die. She does look out the window. This is part 2. There she weaves by day, by night and day, a magic web with colors gay. She has heard a whisper say, a curse is on her if she stay to look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, and so she weaveth steadily, and little other care hath she, the Lady of Shalott. And moving through a mirror clear that hangs before her all the year, shadows of the world appear. There she sees the highway near, winding down to Camelot. But in her web she still delights to weave the mirror's magic sights, for often through the silent nights, a funeral with plumes and lights and music went to Camelot. Or when the moon was overhead, came two young lovers lately wed. "I am half sick of shadows," said the Lady of Shalott. So in that poem, it suggested both that you can't be an artist, a pure artist, if you look out the window, something dies. But it's also clear that you're not part of the world if you never look out the window. And so I think the challenge for us is not to die as we encounter the world, which I translate in a conservative Jewish shul as saying, can we be who we are with integrity, encountering the world, and keep alive the very tradition that got us here? Not survival, but healthy adaptation, a joyous dynamism that in no way makes me feel like I'm not standing on my feet. I have my Siddur and I struggle with it. I'd rather struggle because I know I'm there than have everything be oneness, because I'd be in a fog. I wouldn't know where to go, no one to talk to, not even God. So the blessing that I wish all of us is that we feel the weight of the challenge, that we engage the challenge. We shouldn't abdicate the right, the responsibility to respond to these challenges, but we should not take that simply. We should not measure our ability to respond to new challenges based on our success facing older ones, because they're new. Every question has its own ramifications. These windows are a blessing and a curse. But we really need them if we're going to do this right.